KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Coming up on Forum, the U.S. economy got its bailout on Friday, but will it be enough to improve the economy? The Dow is falling. It went below 10,000 today. What more needs to be done and what is likely to transpire? We'll look in the hour ahead at the fragile status of the economy, what the bailout likely will and won't accomplish. We'll have a range of voices to sort things out. Former Clinton administration Secretary of Labor Robert Reich will join us, and Reagan administration economist David Henderson, and Robert Kuttner of the American Prospect. And your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. On Friday, the United States House of Representatives passed what is being generally described as a $700 billion financial bailout of the nation's financial system with a vote of 263 to 171. That was a bill that had gone through the U.S. Senate and failed the House in a previous form that was altered and amended. What will this mean for Wall Street and for Main Street, and to what extent will it serve to keep the economy stable, especially in light of more bad news this morning of world markets falling and the Dow plunging below 10,000 for the first time in nearly 4 years? We're going to have a number of people joining us to discuss the bill this morning, and for the first half hour, we're going to have Robert Reich with us, who is former Secretary of Labor during the Clinton administration and presently professor of public policy at the Goldman School at UC Berkeley. His latest book, Super Capitalism, now available in paperback. And he joins us by phone. Good morning, Robert Reich. Do we have you with us?
Well, I'm right here. I don't know if you can hear me all right.
I can hear you
fine. I am here in Berkeley.
Glad to have you here with us. Good morning to you. And we'll also say good morning to David Henderson, who's with us in Monterey this morning, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. And welcome, David Henderson.
Thank you, Michael.
Glad to have you both with us. We'll be joined by Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine, in the second half hour. And let me begin, Robert Reich, with you. World markets plunging, the Dow plunging today. I mean, this was not supposed to happen. The bailout was supposed to kind of lift all boats, I thought, wasn't it?
Well, no, the bailout was not designed to lift all boats, Michael. It was designed to free up credit markets with a fear, and I think a justifiable fear, that credit markets were seizing up because of everything that's happened from the subprime mortgage crisis onward, a great deal of distrust on Wall Street. And if the government provided that big a dose of liquidity, $700 billion, maybe $1 trillion, that would restore confidence. At least that was the idea. Now, the actual bailout has not proceeded yet, but there is also a growing fear, apparently, among many, many people out there, not just in the capital markets, but also just ordinary people on Main Street, that this economy is heading downward very, very fast. I believe largely because consumers have reached the end of their ropes. They just can't afford to buy anything anymore.
Yeah, in fact, you had a good article about that in the Sunday paper. You also, in your blog, said that you think, given a choice between a lousy bailout and economic Armageddon, give you the bailout because we needed prompt action. And even though this is a lousy bill, you'll take it.
Well, that's right. If the choice is between those two awful alternatives, obviously a lousy bill is better than nothing. But it is a lousy bill. It doesn't really do much for homeowners. It doesn't extend unemployment insurance. It doesn't have anything in it to generate more jobs. There's no kind of stimulus package attached to it. So it is basically designed Now, I say designed. I'm not sure it's going to accomplish this, but it's basically designed to free up credit markets. But, of course, if people can't afford even to borrow anymore, and they're not going to the malls, and small businesses are not going to borrow money because, after all, if nobody's going to the malls and buying things, small businesses are not going to create things. And then big businesses are not going to create much more. They're not going to produce because people don't have the money to buy. Well, then you have a vicious cycle. And I'm afraid the real problem, again, is that people, the vast American middle class, have just reached the limit of how much debt they can carry, given that their incomes, in real terms, adjusted for inflation, continue to drop.
You're talking about the consumers and putting earnings really here kind of primary, but there's a lot of lack of details in this bill, and about 15,000 jobs lost last month. Now we've got this Wachovia mess. In other words, to some people, it almost seems like we're on the verge of economic Armageddon despite the bailout bill.
Well, let's put it this way. At very best, the bailout was necessary but not sufficient. Was the bailout bill necessary? Well, I think probably something like it. But again, I want to emphasize, people have been on a downward escalator. The vast American middle class earning in real terms less and less. The cost of health insurance and fuel and food and college for the kids and everything else going up faster than inflation. People going deeper and deeper into debt, which was okay as long as housing prices were going up, and because most people were using their houses as kind of piggy banks for refinancing or for home equity loans. But then when that turned around on top of everything else, well, you know, you're just not going to get people to be able to consume. That's why we've got to have a major jobs package, why we have to extend unemployment insurance, why we have to give direct help to people who are in danger of losing their homes, why we have to have a progressive income tax and cut taxes for the middle class, and a lot of things that have to be done before people feel confident enough to start spending again.
You think Congress can do what you've just outlined needs to be done?
Unfortunately, not this Congress. This Congress is about at the end of its run. Most members of Congress are heading back to be, hopefully, they think, they say, reelected. And this administration is a lame duck administration that has no public confidence at all. And the question in my mind, Michael, is whether we can wait for the next administration, whether there's enough time, and what is going to happen to the economy in the meantime.
Talking with former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, who's with us from Berkeley. He is presently the professor of public policy at the Goldman School, UC Berkeley. And David Henderson's also with us, research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics, former member of the Reagan administration. David Henderson, I read your article in Forbes. You said essentially this is a bad idea to put so much power in one man's hands, Secretary Paulson. But I noticed that just off the wires, he's kind of shifted the power, or so it would seem, to Neil Kashkari, a Treasury Assistant Secretary for International Affairs. He said this is going to be interim head of this bailout. Any thoughts about that or what that all means?
Well, yeah. In other words, when I said it's bad to put the power in one man's hands, I didn't say that the man had to be Hank Paulson. It's bad to put all that power in one man's hands, no matter who the man is or the woman is. And so, you know, it was really kind of a Hail Mary, the bailout, where they wouldn't really tell us the details. So it doesn't surprise me that the stock market fell, because we don't really know what they're going to do. In a way, the Congress and the Bush administration have created a huge noise trader. And they never specified Bernanke, and this was one of the most troublesome parts. Bernanke, when he was testifying before Congress, many people had thought, well, they're going to buy these assets at fire sale prices, and they might make money for the Treasury. But then when he said they're going to pay hold to maturity prices, that's when it became clear it literally is a bailout. And so, and by the way, they never made the argument about how this would unfreeze credit markets, and they never made the argument that credit markets are indeed frozen. The best they could do is point out that banks weren't lending to other banks, and that was over a few weeks. I tried to just get data on that by talking to people locally. Do you have trouble getting a car loan? Do you have trouble getting a mortgage? Do you have trouble getting an equity line? And then the answer in all cases was yes, if by trouble you mean, hey, they really want 20% down, and gee, they really want to check my income. But you know, that's the kind of trouble you had. In other words, what's happening is not a freezing of capital markets, but rather a tightening of standards in line with a lot of what us critics have been saying, what we critics have been saying for many months now, should be done. And so they never really made the case. And it's very hard to know what will happen with this bailout, because they have such incredibly arbitrary discretionary power, and we may never know.
Well, where's the oversight? Where's the accountability or the transparency?
Yeah, Yeah.
Actually, I want to get some of the lingo down here. Noise trader is a term that's used to describe an investor who makes decisions regarding buy and sell trades without the use of fundamental data. And you talk about credit. Speaking about lingo, you talk about credit loans not seizing up. What do you mean?
That just what I meant. That was what I said. In other words, you can get credit all over the place. You can get credit to buy a car. You can get credit to buy a house. You can get an equity line. It's just they've tightened those standards. And there was a lot of good reason to tighten those standards. And in fact, if they had tightened those standards some years ago, which, by the way, means if Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac had not, among other players, pushed in the direction of loosening standards, then we wouldn't be in nearly the mess we're in today.
And by your standards, this is pretty much a liquidity problem then, isn't it?
Yes, that's right. In other words, first of all, if it's a problem, in other words, they never even established that. But what I said in the Forbes.com article is that if it were a problem, then we do have the tools now to handle it. And the two main tools are FDIC to prevent, assure people that they don't have to do a run on their bank, and then in case that assurance doesn't work, the Fed is the lender of last resort. Bernanke made his academic reputation studying the Depression, so he knows that the Fed has the power to prevent another Great Depression. In fact, at Milton Friedman's 90th birthday party, Bernanke said, "Milton, you're right. We blew it. We caused the Depression. We promise we won't do it again."
Which makes you think that Bernanke panicked in all this. Huh?
He did panic. And in fact, my article was titled Bernanke's Hype.
Let me go to Robert Reich, because Robert Reich, one of the talking points of this administration or of the GOP in general has been kind of blaming or holding culpable Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac. Let's get your response to that.
Well, undoubtedly, those two big institutions are partly responsible for the mess, as are a lot of mortgage lenders and a lot of the big banking institutions. I mean, everybody in the time when earlier this decade money was extremely cheap, when Alan Greenspan and the Fed pushed short-term interest rates down to 1%, which adjusted for inflation really is a negative interest rate, there was every incentive for every major bank, including Fannie and Freddie, to get money out the door to everybody as fast as they could, regardless of lending standards. And a lot of the people they got the money out to were bad risks. They didn't care because, again, Fannie and Freddie and the others are all in business not to get loans out to bad credit risks, but they're in business to maximize short-term profits. And that's what they all were doing, and nobody was looking over their shoulders. I mean, Alan Greenspan himself said, I don't think there's any need for more oversight or more regulation. The Comptroller of the Currency said the same thing. The Treasury Department said the same thing. Even though money was extremely cheap and there were a lot of lending standard violations, everybody looked the other way because so much money was being made. So eventually the bubble would burst. Eventually, inevitably, we would pay this price, Michael. But you see, I think it's larger than that. What I want to stress is that this has been building for many, many years. The American middle class has not really taken, got a big chunk of the gains of the economy as a whole. Even over the last few years, as the American economy has grown, middle class incomes have basically stagnated. So once the bubble burst and middle class people could not get access to more credit, essentially they had no choice but to pull in their belts and stop buying. Now, this may be appropriate, it may be good over the long term, but certainly it's going to be a tremendous, it's going to mean a tremendous downturn for the American economy over the next year or two, or maybe some people are predicting 5 years.
Yeah, what's the likelihood of the government turning a profit on these assets it's going to sell?
I think it's fairly unlikely. If housing prices turn around in the next year and a half or so, it is certainly possible that if the government buys these mortgage-backed securities on, say, maybe it's 20 cents on the dollar, if there's a reverse auction, yes, government could make some money. But on the other hand, as your other guest was noting before, it's not clear exactly what the Treasury is doing. Some people in the Treasury tell me that they conceive of their jobs not as getting these mortgage-backed securities from the banks at the cheapest possible price. They want to recapitalize the banks. They want to give the banks enough money that the banks can basically go on and functioning pretty much as before, which means that instead of 20 cents on the dollar, they're going to be paying 35 or 40 cents on the dollar. Well, if they're doing that, then the chance of the taxpayer actually recouping all of that may be less.
Well, David Henderson, some are saying that the regional banks may benefit, but what about the big ones? What about, you know, the Wachovia-type banks?
I'd like to get to Wachovia, but could I just add something in addition to what Robert Reich is saying? I was on a conference call with they have these occasional White House conference calls on the economy, and for some reason I'm on the list, although after my Forbes article I might not be anymore, I'm not sure. But I was on a different one with Ed Gillespie, who was in the White House, and he was basically lobbying on government time, as far as I could tell, with all these people on the other end of the line to push for this before it passed. And the first, you get to push a certain button and you get to ask a question. And the first question was from the guy from the National Association of Home Builders. And it's like, wait a minute. And he was basically saying, yeah, get this passed and we can keep on building. And it's like, whoa, that is part of the problem, is that we need this major adjustment. I mean, what's happened is various assets are now known to be risky and the prices should adjust. And it looks as if the Treasury sees itself as the entity that wants to prevent those prices from adjusting, or at least reduce, dampen the adjustment. In fact, we need the adjustment. We need the market signal about where investment should go and where it shouldn't. And this is just destroying those market signals. On the Wachovia Bank issue, I think that the issue is very clear. Should Wachovia have waited and gotten the better deal from Wells Fargo now that they know there's this better deal? Absolutely. But a deal is a deal. And Wachovia agreed with Citibank, we will not consider any other offers up until, I guess it was today. And they broke their agreement. And the way we have any shot at getting out of this is by enforcing agreements, not by saying we're going to have the government let people out of agreements because they got a better deal. I mean, that's just really poor public policy. Contracts have to be sacred. Contracts have to be enforced, or else we're going to be not in the five-year problem that Robert Reich talks about, but in a problem forever.
Well, it seems like we've got a problem in the sense that there's no plan B as far as the bailout is concerned, is there?
I think that's right.
I think that's right, Michael and David, if you permit me. I don't see that there is a backup plan. Now, my backup plan, it's not even a backup plan. It's sort of an emergency plan that has to be put into right away, is to help distressed homeowners and extend unemployment insurance and have a substantial jobs bill, a stimulus bill, passed right away, because otherwise I don't see how the economy really can get going, at least on Main Street. From my perspective, Main Street is at least as important, if not more important, than Wall Street.
Well, you've got 6 million expected to lose their mortgages, right?
Exactly. And if you have, for every person or a family expected to lose their mortgages, there are 10 others who are worried that they may lose their mortgages. And so you create and we have this in the population right now, a huge fear. So all discretionary spending has basically stopped. Now, some people who think that we spend too much and we live beyond our means anyway might say, well, that's great. We should just shrink the economy and get back to what we can afford. Well, over the long term, maybe they're right, but the transition from what we have now to what that might be at some future could be extraordinarily painful. I mean, we're talking about not just the 700,000 people who have lost their jobs over the last since January. In fact, if you really count it correctly, it's more like 2 million. But we're talking about millions and millions of people who are unemployed, and a great deal of deep recession-like, if not depression-like consequences.
Let me invite those of you. Excuse me just a second, David Henderson. I want to give out the phone number because I know there are many people who would like to join us here, and I want to at least give them access. In fact, if you would like to join us, you can do so now. Our toll-free number is available to you, whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or Sirius satellite. It's 866-733-7625. 833-6786. And that's toll-free for any of your questions or comments, 866-733-6786. You can also send an email to forum@kqed.org. David Henderson, sorry.
I'd like to just address Bob's plan. By the way, do you prefer Bob or Robert?
Your Highness would be ideal. Or Bob is perfectly fine.
I'd like to address Bob's plan B. I guess he would call it plan A, and because here we really do part company, even though we've agreed on some other things. The unemployment insurance extension, economists have found, not surprisingly, increases unemployment. That, you know, if people can wait longer and get 13 additional weeks of pay, they'll be unemployed longer. So I did a calculation for a congressional staffer a couple of weeks ago in response to a request that showed that based on past academic research by economists, the unemployment extension that happened in, I believe, June is responsible for roughly 0.3 of a percentage point of our current unemployment. So instead of being at 6.1, without that, we'd be at 5.8, which is not bad. The second thing is that jobs programs don't work. And why is that? Because they basically take money that then the government spends on jobs, and we don't have much of a market test for whether those jobs are creating valuable output. And then that's money that doesn't go elsewhere. So one of the worst things we can do now is a jobs program. And finally, I don't agree with Bob that middle-income people have done badly. Surely when the data come out this year, I'm guessing he's right that it will show them doing badly this year. But over the long term, including even the last 8 years, they have not done badly when you inflation adjust correctly. The inflation data, the CPI, overstate inflation by about 0.8 to 1 percentage point a year. And that doesn't just add up, that compounds up. And so if you inflation adjust correctly and take in account people's, not just people's wages, but benefits they get from their employer, the vast majority of people are doing better than they were. And in fact, say 2007, we were pretty much in 2007 at an all-time high.
Well, I'd say there's a pretty serious disagreement.
Well, yeah. And on the basis of that, David, you can call me Mr. Reich or Professor Reich rather than Bob. But look, I don't know if we have time, Michael, or you have time, but I'd just like to very quickly respond to each of those because David is right. Unemployment insurance in normal times, if you make it more generous, some people will say, well, I'd rather have unemployment insurance than get a job. But right now, we don't have normal times. There's a very severe job contraction. We've had now 9 months in a row in which we have fewer jobs in this country than we had before, and a lot of people just can't find jobs. So an extension of unemployment insurance is one way to make sure that they and their families can basically maintain themselves. With regard to a jobs program, David's point, jobs programs don't work. Well, we know that, again, if there's substantial underutilization of the capacity of the country, not only in terms of unemployment, but also factories that are empty and office space that goes wanting. In other words, if we are in a deep recession, then a stimulus package, government actually generating, because government is the spender of last resort, some sort of demand, is absolutely necessary. I mean, John Maynard Keynes, I don't think every aspect of his philosophy is appropriate, but the supply-siders don't have all the answers either. We do have to have government as the spender of last resort. And finally, this notion that middle-income people have not fared that badly over the last 8 years. We can play all sorts of tricks with numbers in terms of the inflation or deflator we use. But the fact of the matter is almost everybody knows, and you don't have to be a rocket scientist or even an economist to go on Main Street and see that people are hurting because of, again, fuel and food and the destruction of the housing market that they were counting on and all the other expenses like health insurance that are rising faster than almost any inflation index we have.
Robert Reich, that's going to have to conclude. I know you have a class. I extend thanks to you and appreciate very much your being with us. We're going to have to say goodbye to Secretary Reich, or His Highness, but we'll get Robert Kuttner with us, and we will get to your calls. Stay tuned. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Well, the Senate and House have approved an amended bailout bill, but economists are saying it's still not enough to really improve the economy, and Today, if you've been watching the economy, the Dow Jones Industrial fell, well, the lowest in 4 years, below 10,000, and the foreign markets are falling, and global economy is looking, well, quite fragile, at least as we go to press here, so to speak. Robert Rice joined us earlier, former Secretary of Labor with the Clinton administration, and David Henderson is with us. He's a research fellow with the Hoover Institution at Stanford and editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics. And I want to get Robert Kuttner on with us as well for this remaining half hour, co-editor of the American Prospect magazine and a columnist with the Boston Globe, as well as the author of a book called Obama's Challenge, America's Economic Crisis and the Power of a Transformative Presidency. And welcome, Robert Kuttner.
Thank you for having me.
Glad to have you. Actually, I was talking to my producer beforehand, and maybe we can get a rundown from you on this, because I know that you've been talking about deeper rot within the system, and I want to sort of get what your thoughts are along those lines. But the confidence in financial markets is down, well, it was 36% in the year 2000. It's about 10% now. And here we have this bailout, and I don't know if you heard the first hour, but a lot of criticism of the bailout, even from Robert Rice, who said, well, it may be necessary, all we have. What I'm curious to know about you is all of these add-ons on this bailout. I mean, $700 billion sounds expensive, but there are administrative costs of a few billion a year. There are provisions to essentially, well, do much more, clean energy tax incentives, disaster relief, other things that will, earmarks that will really bring this up well above $700 billion.
The whole approach is wrong. The idea that you could somehow fix what's broken by sopping up bad bonds and having the Treasury bail out the people who bought them, that's not going to fix what's broken. And you've seen the financial markets' response to the fact that Congress passed and the president signed this package. Markets are down. And Congress adding a few additional bells and whistles on a plan that was the wrong plan to begin with, that doesn't help. And if I may, this is the fruit of 30 years of deregulation. We've destroyed the financial system, and now it's going to have to be rebuilt from scratch, and you don't do that by just buying up a bunch of bad bonds.
Well, I'm going to get a response, obviously, from David Henderson on that, but before I do, you talk about, as I indicated, deeper rot within the system.
Yes.
And you pretty much single out in articles that I've read by you hedge funds and derivatives, and those continue to give us the kinds of problems, or will give us the kind of problems that we've seen?
Well, it isn't just hedge funds and derivatives. It's deregulation across the board. I mean, for the past 30 years, the Republicans were the worst culprit, but a lot of Democrats climbed on board this train, too, like Bob Rubin. Idea was that markets could police themselves, and that if the financial markets invented something, by definition, it had to be a good innovation. And they have created such a convoluted, complicated system of exotic products that in turn has allowed pyramiding, degrees of leverage that turn the financial system into a casino. And now the whole thing is going into reverse, because it dawned on people that a lot of these securities were not worth what people thought they were. And you're going to have to go back to a kind of a Roosevelt conception of the financial system, where it's highly regulated, where government has to come in and recapitalize some of these institutions, but in return, make sure that going forward they don't play these kinds of games again. And I think the basic problem with the Paulson plan is twofold. First, instead of just refinancing these mortgages, which is what Roosevelt did in the 30s through the Homeowners Loan Corporation, so that the relief hits where people need it most, in mortgages that are at risk of foreclosure. Instead, they try and give the bondholders something and hope that some of it trickles down to homeowners. They just should have refinanced the mortgages directly. And secondly, I think they're going to need to recapitalize some of the banks directly, get rid of the rot, and build it back up. And I don't think Congress is there yet. But I think this thing is unraveling so fast that Congress is going to probably get there within the next 4 to 6 weeks, or we could see a depression.
Well, you've talked about direct government financing of distressed mortgages and direct government equity investment in troubled banks, but you also want to extend FDIC-style supervision, and you also have written about the need for greater global regulation. I mean, we're seeing
that's
global,
right. Yeah. And I'm happy to report that in his March 27th speech, Barack Obama said much the same thing, that if it quacks like a bank, you have to regulate it like a bank. And the problem now is that whether an institution calls itself a commercial bank or an investment bank or hedge funds or private equity or Donald Duck. They're all introducing the same kinds of toxic products to the financial system. They are having borrowing ratios at 30 and 35 to 1. And the government is the security umbrella, the lender of last resort, whether it's technically an FDIC-insured institution or not. They've just extended the umbrella to money market funds. They've extended the umbrella to AIG, an insurance conglomerate. They've extended the security umbrella to investment banks. And I think that's necessary under the circumstances. But the flip side is if they're going to extend the security umbrella, then they have to have the same degree of prudential regulation that a commercial bank gets so that examiners go in, they examine the quality of its assets, they require the bank to reserve against bad investments, and that's what we're going to have, at least for a time, until the banking system gets back to normal. And Obama, who seems to be likely to be the next president, no offense to the Hoover Institution, but he's going to have to be the next Roosevelt, or he's going to end up being the next Hoover.
Well, we're going to go to your calls here. A lot of people waiting who want to weigh in here. But David Henderson, I would be remiss if I didn't give you an opportunity to respond to what you just heard from Robert Kuttner.
Well, it's not, as you might expect, completely critical. It's critical and agreeing. Let me just say on the deregulation, that's where I mainly disagree, that the Community Reinvestment Act passed in the 70s and then strengthened in the Clinton administration in the mid-90s is one of the culprits in this. It pushed banks to drop their lending standards, not to check income, not to check, actually do good assessments of the value of a house, appraisals of the house, and so on. So that's a major culprit, and I think of that, and I think most people would think of that as regulation, not deregulation. Having said that, I think that Bob is right. By the way, Bob or Robert? I'd asked this before of Robert Reich.
Bob got here.
But I think Bob is right that there is this implicit assumption that the feds will come in and bail you out, and now we know that that assumption has turned out to be true. So there are two ways to go here. One is to say, we're going to bail you out, which is what he's advocating, and we're going to regulate you heavily. The other is to say, we're not going to bail you out. That's why I was a critic back in March of the Bear Stearns bailout. I was a critic of the AIG bailout, of the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac bailout. That's the problem. So now you might say, and he might make a good point to say, well, politically that's not going to happen. And unfortunately, that might be right. But then at least let's get the economics right. Let's get the analysis right. A bailout is, in a sense, a form of regulation. A bailout sends a certain message. We aren't going to let market forces run things. We're going to, when you make bad decisions ex post, we're going to make up your losses. That's not a free market.
Well,
and by the way, no insult against the Hoover Institution taken, because in fact, Hoover was very much an early Roosevelt. Hoover was not this laissez-faire guy. He was from the hard left wing of the Republican Party.
May I respond on two quick
Robert
counts?
Kuttner, or Bob
First
Kuttner,
of all, I wrote the Community Reinvestment Act. It's something of which I'm very proud. And the claim that the Community Reinvestment Act had anything to do with it is a slander for the following reason. For the first 20 years of its existence, the Community Reinvestment Act did not weaken underwriting standards, and banks did not get into trouble by putting money into moderate-income communities. The mortgage companies that created this mess were unregulated. They were storefront mortgage brokers who were not even governed by the Community Reinvestment Act. So this is a story that the political right tells. It's 100% wrong. Nobody who made these subprime mortgages had anything whatever to do with the Community Reinvestment Act. That's point one. Point two, it was Andrew Mellon, Herbert Hoover's Secretary of the Treasury, who said when the stock market crashed, the thing to do is purge the rot. And I'm not willing to take the risk that the entire economy go into a Great Depression, too. I think bailing out after the fact is a bad idea unless you have a lot of prudential regulation before the fact. And the mistake that public policymakers made was they threw away the rule book and they let financial institutions invent crazy kinds of instruments which now have crashed the financial system. After the fact, the question is, do you just let it bleed to the point where you have a Great Depression? or do you pump in public money and try and get the economy back on its feet? I think the latter is the better course. But then going forward, you have to re-regulate this so that they never, ever, ever do this again.
Let me go to your calls, but before I do, let me go to your emails and get some responses from our listeners to what they've heard. Here's a listener who says, why aren't you guests talking about the incredible irresponsibility of this bailout bill regarding pork? At this most serious time, lawmakers are loading up a rescue bill with $150 billion in pork. I'm so outraged, ready to march on Washington. What do we have to do to get a clear message to lawmakers to get some integrity and take care of the business at hand? That's a strong editorial comment. Here's a listener in Sacramento who says, National Public Radio mentioned just yesterday that the bill allows the Treasury Secretary to invest in a preferred interest in banks rather than worthless mortgage paper. Shouldn't he be advised to move as quickly as possible in this direction? David Henderson?
Yeah, the first one, I think you should vote against everyone who voted for the bill. That's my solution. But I want to respond on the Depression. The point is, the reason for the Depression was the bank failures, which were caused by the runs on banks. And we know how to prevent this, bailout or no bailout. It's to have the FDIC. It's to have the Fed as the lender of last resort. And so that is the snow job that Bernanke and Paulson pushed, was that somehow we are risking another Depression. On the point about regulation, again, I'm not saying CRA, Community Reinvestment Act, was the whole story. It was part of the story, and it wasn't the 77 law. It was the law after 95, after the revisions that pushed in this direction.
Let's get a caller on here. Steve, go ahead. You're on. Morning.
Yes. I was wondering if what guests could briefly explain the Glass-Steagall Act, and had it not been repealed, would that have mitigated or even prevented the current situation?
Yeah, it certainly keeps coming up, Robert Kuttner, as something that should have been done. Your thoughts?
Well, I think it's a complicated story. Let me try and give you the headlines. By the time Glass-Steagall was officially repealed in 1999, it had been hollowed out by actions by conservative regulators who basically let banks violate the Glass-Steagall Act. Remember, Glass-Steagall said you're either a commercial bank and you're tightly regulated, or you're an investment bank and you can do almost anything you want as long as it's not fraudulent. And the repeal of Glass-Steagall allowed for financial supermarkets with all kinds of internal conflicts of interest with depositor money. And most of the provisions of the Glass-Steagall Act had, in effect, been repealed administratively before Congress got around to finally officially burying it. However, the other part of the story is that beginning in the 1970s, all kinds of new exotic financial instruments that nobody understood very well were invented, and the regulators failed to keep up with them. I mean, in the 30s, there were no such things as hedge funds, no such things as private equity. So merely keeping Glass-Steagall would not have solved the problem. What regulators failed to do, and what they need to do going forward, is keep up with the scams that get invented on Wall Street. Otherwise, we're going to have this a third time.
Let me thank the caller. I want to get some more of your calls and emails on. Daniel joins us next morning. Daniel.
Hi. I had a odd question. I've been seeing a lot of mention in alternative news sources on the internet and such about this $1 quadrillion in derivatives debt, and I haven't seen a whole lot of that in the mainstream news, so I was hoping to get some professional opinion on what exactly that's about and how much it's contributing to the current situation.
Well, I mentioned derivatives before to you, Robert Kuttner, because you
call
attention in your articles to derivatives. Here.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, here's the problem. Somebody buys up a bunch of mortgages that are riskier than they admit. They package them into bonds. They slice them and dice them. They sell them off. That's a first-order derivative. Then somebody else comes along and says, I'm going to insure these bonds against default. So the investor says, hey, this is a great deal. I can buy bonds that pay a slightly higher rate than I think they ought to, but this is not my problem, because somebody is going to insure me against them. So so-called credit default swaps, which are a second-order derivative, if you will, have a value of $60 or $70 trillion. And it was this one little unit in London that speculated in credit default swaps that took down the world's biggest insurance conglomerate. Now, it seems to me that
AIG.
This is a perfect example of an instrument that never should have been permitted to exist, because if you think about it, and the concept here is moral hazard, if I, as a bondholder, know that somebody else is insuring the bond, I don't exercise as much diligence over the quality of the bond as I otherwise might. And the guy who is writing literally trillions of dollars of insurance coverage based on the wild guess that, hey, these things never go bust anyway, so I can make a lot of money charging a very little bit for insuring an astronomical amount of the value of bonds against default, and then they default, bingo, he's out of business. So I think we need a whole investigation of which kinds of derivatives add value and which kinds of derivatives simply add risk. My sense is a lot of them add more risk than they add value. Phil Graham is the culprit here. Phil Graham sneaked into a bill in 2000, legislation on behalf of Enron. And Graham is one of McCain's chief guys, by the way. He sneaked into this bill a provision making it much harder to regulate credit default swaps. This is how the game is played, and the crisis is so serious that Congress and the next administration, which I hope will be the Obama administration, is going to have to go back to basics and simplify the financial system so that we don't get taken down by all these exotic instruments that nobody understands.
I'm inclined to, before I go to some more of your calls, read yet another email here. And David Henderson, get your response to this email that comes from Craig, who says, because we're back to the bailout here, wasn't the $700 billion bailout just an exercise in Rumpelstiltskin economics where the feds were going to buy the bad straw paper and try to turn it into gold? And could the Dow drop another 400 to 500 points because stock prices are too high in relation to the annual income of most Dow-listed companies?
Yeah, certainly it could drop 400 or 500 points. And of course, my point about the first point is that it is buying bad paper. I'd like to get back to Glass-Steagall and also to the derivatives. Glass-Steagall, it turns out, is not really a culprit in this. Now, actually, I admit that when I looked around for culprits, that was one of the ones I considered because I was concerned about letting them invest when you've got the FDIC backing up, the left tail, the distribution, the bad bets. But it turns out that certainly hasn't been a culprit here. In fact, it's what allowed Bank of America to buy Merrill Lynch. In fact, it's interesting if you look back at the history of the Glass-Steagall Act, Alex Tabarrok, an economist at George Mason University, pointed out that it really was the result of a titanic struggle between the Rockefellers and the Morgans. And so just a fascinating story about that, how they, one tried to raise the rival's costs. The thing about derivatives, it is true there are all these risks with derivatives. Here's the problem. If you try to regulate them, it's kind of like whack-a-mole. The various people who want to do this, because there is this underlying rationale, even though things can go bad, there is this insurance rationale that Bob Kuttner talked about, then if you make a certain kind of derivative illegal, that stops it. Then companies that want to do what the market wants done will look around for ways, a new kind of derivative that handles that problem. And there's just a fascinating article that's referenced in marginalrevolution.com that talks about how this has been a big part of what's happened. In the more regulated companies are getting into derivatives more because it's a way around some of the capital constraints. So again, the fundamental problem, the root of the problem, is this idea that the Fed will bail us out of bad decisions. If we don't have that, we're going to have bad decisions. And it isn't just Wall Street. It is Main Street. It is people buying houses they couldn't afford. And it isn't just loan brokers, although they bear a lot of the blame. It's people lying. And people lying are responsible for their lies.
Oh, man. Can I come back on that?
I think you're going to have to, or maybe we'll have to get you tended by a medic or something. Huh?
Talk about blaming the victim. I mean, what these loan brokers did was they marketed very hard sell. All you got to do is go to the internet or go to your local cheesy television station. And even to this day, you'll see these hard sell mortgage things. And they had a product called a ninja loan. A ninja loan stood for no income, no job, no assets. They said to the home buyer, we don't want any credit verification. We don't want to know your income. They weren't even falsifying income because the lender didn't ask. And then they trapped people into, through deceptive non-disclosure, taking out these mafia loans where after a couple of years, the rate goes through the roof. And some poor guy is trying to get a little piece of the American dream. And instead of blaming the bastards on Wall Street who did this, you blame the homeowner? Give me a break.
Blame both. In other words,
Bob, oh, man, not both.
No, come on, I let you talk. Bob points correctly to the fact that there were brokers doing that. I'm pointing out there's something else. There were people actually lying on their loan forms. That is just a fact.
There was a lot of predatory lending, but there were a lot of people who were very naive. And
there was a lot of predatory borrowing. That's my only point. I just don't think we should tell part of the story.
Predatory borrowing did not cause this crisis.
Let's get some more calls on. Bill, join us. Good morning.
Good morning. My question was relating to the Community Reinvestment Act. It's my understanding that it forced lenders to use imprudent, non-traditional standards in assigning mortgages, like counting welfare payments and unemployment benefits as income. And in addition, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act allowed activist groups to sue lenders. For example, Senator Obama sued Citibank on behalf of Acorn. In other words, these two pieces of legislation, I think, were a major influence on this financial meltdown.
Well, we're back to causes. Robert Kuttner, I know you want to respond to this call.
The Community Reinvestment Act said that if you're a federally regulated lender, you cannot discriminate against moderate-income communities, and banks would get a scorecard on whether they were offering decent service to moderate-income communities. Most of the vast majority of subprime mortgages and even so-called Alt-A mortgages, which are subprime but not quite so bad, were not originated by federally regulated lenders. The blame for Community Reinvestment Act is a red herring, and the banks that really worked to get credit to low-income people, like Shore Bank of Chicago, a pioneer institution, they don't have any higher default rates than conventional banks. There's a responsible way of making it possible for moderate-income people to become homeowners. The brokers who perpetrated this mess and the Wall Street bankers who were their backers, they didn't care about getting low-income people into homes. They cared about getting higher fees, which they could get by extracting higher interest rates.
Yeah, I would just like to point out, look, Bob keeps talking as if I'm saying that Community Reinvestment Act was 100% of the problem. I'm just saying it was a contributor. That is all I'm saying.
It wasn't 1%.
Now, why am I saying that? I'm saying it because his narrative is that this was a problem due to deregulation. Well, when I can point to a major regulation, one it turns out that he advocates and still defends and apparently wrote the original version of, when I can point to the fact that that was part of the problem, even if it was only 20% of the problem, even if it was only 10% of the problem, that should not give your listeners or anyone else confidence that his other solutions are good solutions.
You're entitled to your opinions, but you're not entitled to your facts. And in this case, your facts are totally wrong.
We'll get more callers on here, Chuck. Thanks for waiting. Join us. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks a lot. One position I seem to be hearing this morning is regulation bad, market forces will take care of the problem, to oversimplify, I'm sure. My problem is, it seems to me that because of the focus on short-term gains, the people at the helms of these large financial institutions can make such vast quantities of money in such a short time that when the whole house of cards falls down, when the market forces start to act, they're fairly well insulated by the fact that they've made out like a bandit in the previous, 5 years or so. So it seems to me you need regulation because in some ways market forces are not going to do the trick for because the people who are making the high-level decisions are so well insulated from them.
David Henderson.
Point. But by the way, it's partly regulation that insulated them. We had this wave of takeovers and leveraged buyouts in the 1980s where you could dislodge the current managers of the firm if you were a big enough shareholder, and you could therefore make the firm run better. And those leveraged buyouts and takeovers created hundreds of billions of dollars in wealth, which was a big number in the 80s. Then you had state by state various poison pill laws, various laws that made, anti-takeover legislation. And I remember at the time predicting that you will have managers who are more out of control, and that's a big part of what happened. We need to distinguish between the managers who, as the caller correctly points out, often do think short run, and the owners owners, the stockholders. The stockholders think long run, by definition, a stock, the price of a stock, is the present value of its whole future expected stream of income. And so, again, let's not start in the midst of the story. Let's look at some of the regulatory factors that contributed to it. And by the way, a good thing to do would be to repeal the part of the Williams Act that says that when you acquire more than 5% of the stock in a company, you have to announce it. So it makes it very difficult for people to quietly acquire control, because once people know they're trying to, they hold out for a premium when they're trying to sell their stock.
Let me go back to what to do now with in the aftermath of the bailout, or once the bailout is implemented, after that occurs. And Robert Kuttner, you've said that maybe this is for breakfast, but we're going to have something else for lunch. You've also said that you think there's going to be a taxpayer backlash as a result of looking in your crystal ball where the bailout is concerned. And I've got listeners who are writing, you know, like, why not revive Works Progress Administration, all kinds of FDR type of activity here on the part of government. What are you recommending specifically?
Well, I'm recommending, first of all, to get the financial recapitalization right, not buy the bad papers, but take over some of the banks, get rid of the bad actors as well as the bad paper. And secondly, have direct refinancing of mortgages instead of hoping that some of the benefit trickles down. I think going forward, we're going to have a couple of years of a substantial increase in government spending, some of it deficit financed, some of it financed by restoring taxes on the top 1% or 2%, so that we can rebuild public infrastructure, so that we can rebuild the electricity grid, so that we can invest in green energy. And along the way, create a lot of good jobs, because one of the byproducts of this financial meltdown is that the bottom is going to fall out of demand. People are going to lose their jobs, and communities, cities, states are starting to cut back on spending because their tax rolls are down. And when that happens, you get into a classic depressionary spiral. And just as the only force that can step in and recapitalize banks and re-regulate banks is the federal government, for a couple of years in any case, the only force that can come in and make up for the collapse in private purchasing power is the federal government.
Well, on that note, we're going to have to conclude. We're at the end of the hour. I want to extend thanks to Robert Reich, who joined us earlier. His new book, In Paperback, Supercapitalism, Former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton Administration. Our thanks to David Henderson, who joined us this morning from Monterey, research fellow with Hoover, and also editor of the Concise Encyclopedia of Economics, and Robert Kuttner, co-editor of the American Prospect and columnist for the Boston Globe. Talk about Boston. Next hour, Dennis Lehane will be joining us. He writes all about Boston, author of Mystic River and Gone Baby Gone. Forum senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our producers are Kevin Guillory and Judy Campbell. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and our executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.